Robert F. Kennedy Jr. faced tough questions in the Senate.
Did you say that COVID-19 was a genetically engineered bioweapon that targets black and white people, but spared Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese people?
Birthright citizenship, the 14th Amendment, and executive power sparked debates.
Constitutional amendments cannot and constitutional rights cannot be taken away by a president.
And the West African Regional Bloc ECOWAS formally has three fewer members.
The decision was in the spirit of, quote, regional solidarity and interests of the people.
Today is Thursday, January 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Donald Trump's nominee to serve as the nation's top health official, faced tough questions from senators Wednesday about his views on vaccinations, COVID-19, and the nation's healthcare system. A member of one of America's most famous political families, Kennedy could face a rough road to confirmation. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Donald Trump's choice to lead the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, told senators Wednesday, the United States faces significant health challenges that require fresh thinking.
I've often disturbed the status quo by asking uncomfortable questions. Well, I'm not going to apologize for that. We have massive health problems in this country that we must face honestly.
A former environmental attorney turned healthcare activist and author, Kennedy received strong support from Senate Republicans considering his nomination to lead the $1.7 trillion government agency that controls health care that covers half the nation. Mike Crapo is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee.
You represent a voice for an inspiring coalition of Americans who are deeply committed to improving the health and well-being of our nation.
But Kennedy faces significant concerns about his past statements about vaccines, reproductive rights, and AIDS. Senator Ron Wyden is the top Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee.
Mr. Kennedy has embraced conspiracy theories, quacks, charlatans, especially when it comes to the safety and efficacy of vaccines. He has made it his life's work to sow doubt and discourage parents from getting their kids life-saving vaccines.
Kennedy said some of his most controversial remarks during a podcast interview had been taken out of context.
I said there are no vaccines that are safe and effective, and I was going to continue for every person. Every medicine has people who are sensitive to them, including vaccines.
Right. So
he interrupted me at that point. I've corrected it many times, including on national TV.
Kennedy pledged to support childhood vaccines if confirmed. But senators are concerned about his statements about a range of health issues, including his statements about COVID-19. Democratic Senator Michael Bennett.
Did you say that COVID-19 was a genetically engineered bioweapon that targets black and white people, but spared Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese people?
I didn't say it was deliberately targeted. I just quoted an NIH-funded, an NIH-published study.
His conclusions from a 2020 report have been dismissed by scientists. Kennedy was also asked about his views on key programs impacted by President Trump's foreign aid funding freeze, including PEPFAR, a successful AIDS prevention program. Republican Senator John Cornyn.
I'd like to know whether you support the objectives and goals of PEPFAR, and would you work with me and my colleagues to make sure that this program continues to provide life-saving antiviral drugs to people who are most in need?
I absolutely support PEPFAR, and I will happily work with you to strengthen the program.
The Senate Finance Committee will vote on Kennedy's nomination in the near future. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Now over to Eastern Europe, where U.S. President Donald Trump has promised repeatedly to bring an end to Russia's war on Ukraine, but some Ukrainians are skeptical Trump can do anything to make Russian President Vladimir Putin pull back his troops. The problem, as some analysts see it, is that the demands of Ukraine and Russia cannot be reconciled. Lesia Bakalets reports from Kyiv.
Since his campaign, President Trump has promised to bring an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. But there is no clear strategy on how he will achieve this, says analyst Mykola Beliskov. Beliskov is an analyst with the Comeback Alive Foundation, a charity organization that has helped the Ukrainian army since 2014.
Ukraine and Russia have different positions. Russia demands the occupied territories and an end to NATO's open-door policy. Ukraine will be neutral. Russia demands severe restrictions on Ukraine's defense forces.
Such demands could lead to the ultimate collapse of Ukraine, Beliskov says, and recognizing Russia's takeover of Ukraine's eastern and southern provinces would require a massive political adjustment. Соломія Бобровська, Ukrainian member of parliament.
It may be a change through legislation or even the constitution, but it will be exclusively through parliament. Ukrainian society has to decide.
Agreeing to reduce the armed forces will make Ukraine defenseless, argues Ukrainian professor Valery Pekar. He believes that only the issue of NATO is up for discussion.
If I were negotiating for Ukraine, I would gladly promise not to join NATO for 10 years. First, no one invites us there. We can promise, and the geopolitical situation may change in a few years.
The problem is that's not enough for Putin, says Beliskov. He says that President Biden tried to sell a Ukrainian moratorium on NATO to Putin.
Biden told Putin there was close to zero chance Ukraine would join NATO in the near future. Putin publicly confirmed the conversation late last year and said they're not satisfied with this.
Beliskov says Ukraine's negotiating position must be strengthened. Pekar is sure Putin will press on with the invasion.
Putin thinks things are going well and will not sit for negotiations. President Trump promises big changes in oil prices. The Russian economy will collapse if oil prices drop sharply, but that would require many players to cooperate.
President Trump said he would talk with Putin soon about ending Russia's war against Ukraine. He also stated that Ukraine is ready to make a deal. The problem, according to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, is that Putin is ready to continue the war. Lesia Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
For more on negotiations and how Ukrainians view support from Western allies, we're joined by VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Have there been any recent direct talks between Trump and Zelensky about negotiations with Russia or ideas of how to put pressure on Russia to end the war?
Well, apparently, this is what is discussed inside the country. There are certain talks, there are certain negotiations of the teams of both countries, of the official teams, but we do not have a direct official confirmation that a particular negotiation is taking place. However, of course, everyone understands that Ukrainian government and Ukrainian president, they are in touch with the U.S. administration. And this is something that President Zelensky also said, that, of course, he has a lot of hopes for President Trump and his second term, and that certain things are discussed and that certain things should actually change for Ukraine. But we do not really have any official, information or confirmation or any details.
What has Russia's reaction been to the there's been a lot of ideas put forward by Trump, like OPEC lowering oil prices to put economic pressure on Russia? What has Russia's reaction been to those ideas?
So we've had the official reaction from Putin's spokesperson, Mr. Peskov, and he said that basically Russia did not hear any new threats or any new position from the U.S. administration, from the U.S. officials, and that so everything that Trump mentioned would not really change Russia's position or Russia's perception. However, we can see that both President Putin and also what is circulating in the Russian media Is the message that Russia wants to negotiate, that Russia is ready to negotiate, and Russia is even ready to create to appoint certain people for negotiation. However, President Putin said that President Zelensky cannot be the person to sign anything because President Putin considers President Zelensky as not a legitimate leader, saying that elections did not happen in Ukraine, but we'll understand why and what is the reason why elections did not happen. And according to Ukrainian constitution, when it's war, no elections are possible. And so it's basically not possible, neither physically nor constitutionally.
Do Ukrainians at large feel as if the war in Ukraine is still a priority for Western allies, given how long the war has been going on?
I will put it this way. Ukrainians definitely feel that they have to work harder and they have to fight for this attention more now, and they need to work harder on, you know, spreading information about what's happening, spreading the updates, and making sure that the world remembers that the allies continue to have Ukraine in the spotlight and in the discussions. And as you correctly mentioned, of course, the war is happening for a very long time now, over 10 years, but this full-scale invasion is happening for almost 3, which is also a very long period. So definitely, you know, the prioritization of this is not as it was 3 years ago or 2 years ago. So attention is is going down, and this is one of the tasks for Ukraine now, to make sure that informationally and strategically Ukraine continues to be in the spotlight and in the discussions within their lives.
VOA's Anna Chernikova, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. President Donald Trump says he's directing the opening of a detention center at Guantanamo Bay to hold up to 30,000 migrants living illegally in the United States. Trump made the announcement Wednesday night before signing into law the Laken Riley Act, his administration's first piece of legislation. The bipartisan measure requires the detention of unauthorized migrants accused of theft and violent crimes. Germany's parliament has narrowly approved a call by Chancellor Olaf Scholz's main challenger to turn back many more migrants at the country's borders. Opposition leader Friedrich Merz, a frontrunner in the polls to become the next chancellor, has put migration in the spotlight following a knife attack a week ago by a rejected Afghan asylum seeker who killed a man and a 2-year-old boy. Ahead of the vote, Merz was accused of breaking a consensus to not work with the far-right Alternative for Germany party. The leader of Ontario, Canada's most populous province, on Wednesday triggered a snap election, saying he needs a strong mandate to fight the tariffs threatened by U.S. President Donald Trump. Doug Ford, the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, said the proposed 25% tariffs would devastate Canada's economy and cost Ontario thousands of jobs. Ford's move would send Ontarians to the polls on February 27th, more than a year before the June 2026 fixed election date. Ford already has a large majority government with 79 of the 124 seats in the Ontario legislature. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strobe. President Donald Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship in the U.S. has started a legal and political debate about the 14th Amendment and executive power. The 14th Amendment guarantees citizenship to anyone born on U.S. soil, a principle that has been central to civil rights since its ratification in 1868. VOA's immigration correspondent Alini Barros has more.
The U.S. Constitution, drafted in the late 18th century, left much of the decision-making regarding immigration and citizenship to Congress. But President Donald Trump has signed an executive order ending birthright citizenship in the United States.
We're the only country in the world that does this with birthright, as you know. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, we'll see. We have very good grounds. Sir, people have wanted to do this for decades.
Critics of Trump's executive order say the 14th Amendment is a cornerstone of civil rights and cannot be pulled away by a U.S. president. Here's Duet Duong, an immigration lawyer and policy expert with the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum.
Originally, it was to ensure that Black slaves were able to get citizenship, and this is enshrined in Dred Scott, the case. And constitutional amendments cannot, and constitutional rights cannot be taken away by a president. They can only be taken away by Congress, and thus the executive order is illegal.
However, supporters of the executive order argue it is necessary to restore fairness in the immigration system. Here's Republican Congressman from Texas, Brian Babin.
President Trump has made it clear that restoring fairness to our immigration system and defending the true intent of the 14th Amendment are central to his vision of making America great again. His historic executive order to end birthright citizenship marks a critical step forward.
The executive order faces significant legal challenges, with multiple lawsuits already in progress. Democratic attorneys general from 22 states have filed lawsuits arguing the order violates the 14th Amendment. Here's Duet Duong again.
The Supreme Court reaffirmed it in a case where a lot of Chinese immigrants' citizenship was disputed, and the court reaffirmed that the 14th Amendment applied to these Chinese immigrants and they were able to get citizenship.
A federal judge in Seattle temporarily stopped the birthright citizenship order from taking place. If the case reaches the Supreme Court, the outcome could shape the nation's understanding of citizenship. If the order is allowed to move forward, the most immediate impact will be on newborns and those yet to receive birth certificates and Social Security numbers. Alini Barros, VOA News, Washington.
In a signal that India and China are moving to repair ties damaged by a border standoff, the two countries have decided to resume direct flights. Analysts say while their border dispute continues to remain a concern for India, relations are likely to improve as both countries prepare to face economic uncertainties. Anjana Pasricha has a report from New Delhi.
3 months after a thaw in the frosty ties between India and China, the two countries decided to resume direct commercial flights, suspended for 5 years. Following a visit by India's Foreign Secretary Vikram Misri to Beijing, New Delhi said they will also facilitate exchanges between media and think tanks.
We are on our way to stabilizing the relationship.
Flights suspended during the COVID-19 pandemic were not restarted after ties nosedived following a 2020 border clash. India also had restricted visas for Chinese nationals, including journalists. Now they are repairing frayed ties, says Swaran Singh, professor at the School of International Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University.
Both sides have decided that they really want to come back and rebuild the relationship, resolve their irritants.
Analysts say they expect the Indian and Chinese relationship to gain momentum in 2025, propelled at least partly by the economic uncertainties posed by the threat of potential tariffs by U.S. President Donald Trump against Asia's two biggest economies. Harsh Pant is Vice President Studies at the Observer Research Foundation.
For both China and India, there are enough incentives to work together to engage each other against, you know, what perhaps Mr. Trump might be bringing to the table. Also against slowing down of global economic landscape. So I think if they can stabilize their relationship, build economic ties, then that is in the short term help both these economies to continue their upward trajectory in the global economic order.
The Chinese foreign minister has called on India to prioritize mutual support over suspicion. For the time being, the Asian giants will focus on finding economic convergences. Singh again.
It's not going to be that they will not have challenges. What is important is, are they willing to showcase commitment to deal with those with minimal costs and build partnerships in as many sectors as possible? I think that kind of mood is increasingly becoming visible.
Despite steps to improve ties, however, their disputed frontier continues to be heavily militarized. India's army chief has called the border stable but sensitive. It remains to be seen whether troop levels will be reduced in the coming months. Anjana Pusricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
The West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, has formally recognized the withdrawal of Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso after more than a year of diplomatic tensions. The latest development marks a significant shift in regional diplomacy. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, announced the three countries' withdrawal in a statement Wednesday. But ECOWAS urged its remaining 12 members to continue to recognize the national passports of the departing nations and trade with them until otherwise advised. ECOWAS President Omar Touré told reporters in Abuja, where the bloc has its headquarters, that the decision was in the spirit of, quote, regional solidarity and interests of the people, end quote. He said the commission had invited the three countries to a technical meeting, noting that any member state was welcome to return. Relations between the trio and the regional bloc soured after the July 2023 coup that ousted Niger's president Mohamed Bazoum, prompting ECOWAS to demand his reinstatement and threaten military intervention. In response, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso announced their exit last January and accused ECOWAS of failing to safeguard member states and of aligning too closely with foreign powers. They also created a confederation called the Alliance of Sahel States and strengthened alliances with Russia, Turkey, and Iran to address internal security threats such as jihadists and armed gangs, as well as external pressures. ECOWAS, founded in 1975, is West Africa's most influential political and economic bloc, but has faced difficulties in recent years amid a rash of military takeovers. In December, it granted the three departing countries a six-month grace period to reconsider their decision. But on Tuesday, thousands of people rallied in support of the exit in Niger and Burkina Faso. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And finally today, according to Harvard University, about 200 copies of the original Declaration of Independence were produced in 1776, but only about two dozen remain. In New York, a new copy from the times of the Founding Fathers was discovered. On January 24th, it was put up for auction. Alina Wolf has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. These are the famous opening words of the Declaration of Independence. At the time of its signing, in the summer of 1776, about 200 copies were in print. One of those was recently discovered in the state of New York. Peter Clarinet is from Christie's Auction House.
This was discovered in a volume of the 1782 edition of the Laws of the State of New York. It is the only manuscript of the Declaration of Independence in private ownership written in the 18th century by a member of the founding generation.
Such findings are extremely rare. According to Harvard University, there are only 26 handwritten copies of the Declaration of Independence that exist today, but only this one ended up in private possession. Christie's in New York auctioned this rare copy for $2,470,000 on January 24th as part of the Americana auction. Every 4 years in January, right around the time of presidential inauguration, Sotheby's and Christie's auction houses simultaneously hold auctions for all kinds of pieces from American history. From the golden spike with which President Warren Harding marked the completion of the Alaska Railroad,
that's most fingerprints,
to a silver coffee pot from Boston, says Sotheby's Alessandra Merrill.
The coffee pot is the earliest piece. It's pre-American Revolution. It's circa 1770, 1775.
These objects are all part of the Americana auction, and according to Eric Groning from Sotheby's, help to tell America's story.
What were the people that lived in America 200, 300, even 400 years ago? What did they live with? How did they live with it? And these pieces tell them intimately, right up close. You can touch with them. You can sit at it. You can eat at it.
The Americana auction just wrapped up, and items for sale included classic writings by authors like Francis Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, collections of rare bottles of bourbon and wine, and silver pieces from the 1893 World's Fair held in Chicago. For Yelena Wolf in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe. Thanks for listening.